From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Book Week concludes. We turn up the volume on TV and film with three writers. TV writer Paul Feig confirms our suspicions that his show Freaks and Geeks was autobiographical. His recent memoir is called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. Also, the late Jack Gould was one of television's original critics. He started writing for the New York Times in 1947. We'll meet Gould's son Lou Gould, who published a collection of his father's reviews and essays about television called Watching Television Come of Age. And we talk with film critic David Thompson. There's a new edition of his 25-year-old biographical dictionary of film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal officials in Seattle have announced the arrest of a Minnesota man accused of making a variant of the blaster internet worm. They say Jeffrey Lee Parson, an 18-year-old from the Minneapolis suburbs, has admitted to copying blaster and creating a version known as Lovesan. U.S. Attorney John McKay said authorities want this arrest to serve as an example.
Cyber hacking harms persons and it harms businesses. We will investigate, arrest, and prosecute cyber hackers.
Parsons was described by a neighbor as a loner but not a criminal. Blaster and its variants are believed to have infected hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide. The creator of the original Blaster has not yet been found. An apparent car bomb killed at least 75 people and wounded more than 100 today outside a Shiite mosque in the Iraqi city of Najaf. Among the dead was an influential Shiite Muslim cleric and political leader. NPR's Ivan Watson says people in the Shiite religious center are reacting with shock and anger.
In the first hours, the reaction has been one of shock, anguish in some cases, and fury as well. Some people lashing out at foreign targets, for instance. In the immediate aftermath of the explosion, people yelling Allahu Akbar, God is great, and swearing revenge on everything from the Israelis to the Americans to Wahhabi, more kind of extremist Sunni Muslims, and even to other rival clerics of Shia Islam. At this stage, the civil administrator, the American civil administrator here, has called this an act of terrorism. He has denounced this.
NPR's Ivan Watson in the Shiite holy city of Najaf. Watson was a witness to the bombing earlier this morning. The six nations meeting to discuss North Korea's nuclear program have concluded their summit with an agreement to meet again within 2 months. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing that diplomats from several of the countries sought to downplay North Korea's threat yesterday to test a nuclear weapon.
Seems to be the sort of classical North Korean negotiating strategy is to sound very fierce and make threats on the one hand, but also hold out olive branches on the other. So they have said that a deal is by no means out of reach if the United States does certain things like sign a non-aggression treaty, like restart economic aid. So it has not been all thunder and lightning from the North Koreans. There have been a few conciliatory noises as well.
NPR's Rob Gifford reporting from Beijing. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 41 points to close at 9,415 in light trading. The Nasdaq gained 10 points to close at 1810. This is NPR News. Congressman Bill Janklow has been charged with second-degree manslaughter in the death of a motorcyclist. The South Dakota Republican is accused of running a stop sign at more than 70 miles an hour on a rural road in his home state. A motorcyclist collided with Janklow's Cadillac and was killed. If he's convicted, Janklow could face up to 10 years in prison. The number of U.S. travelers heading out of town this Labor Day weekend is expected to be the highest in 8 years. Most Americans are opting to drive rather than fly. Eric Roy reports from member station KCRW.
The American Automobile Association estimates that better than 33 million people will drive at least 50 miles over the three-day Labor Day weekend, up more than 2% from last year. The AAA's travel survey also shows 3.7 million people will be flying. That's a drop of more than 2.5%. Auto Association spokesman Justin McNall says cutbacks in airline flights, airport security hassles, and a desire for greater travel flexibility have pushed more Americans onto the road. That despite gasoline prices having hit a nationwide average of $1.75 this week. In addition, having more drivers on the highway will put increased pressure on already tight gasoline supplies and could cause huge traffic jams when everyone comes home Monday. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
A consortium of banks led by J.P. Morgan Chase & Company has been named to operate a commercial bank in Iraq. The Treasury Department said Morgan was chosen by the U.S. Civilian Administration in Baghdad to run the Trade Bank of Iraq. The Trade Bank was created to back up the credit of Iraqi agencies and oil businesses when they buy agricultural goods, equipment, and other products from the U.S. and other countries. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Warner Home Video, featuring Roger and Me, Michael Moore's first film, available now on DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We conclude our book week with TV and film writers. Paul Feig is an author and TV writer who's at work right now on a new series for HBO. It's about the same subject matter he's written about almost his entire career. Slightly nerdy young people who don't quite fit in, but wish they did. Feig was the creator of the short-lived but much-admired NBC sitcom Freaks and Geeks, which was set in high school, and co-creator of the Fox sitcom Undeclared, which was set in college. Fans of those shows may suspect that Paul Feig was kind of nerdy himself when he was growing up, and his memoir, now out in paperback, confirms those suspicions. It's called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. Terry spoke with Feig last fall. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of his memoir.
There is no God. I mean, there can't be. Think about it. If there were, then things in life would have to be fair. There would be no suffering, there would be no war, there would be no poverty, and none of us would be born with last names that could make us the brunt of adolescent jokes for the entirety of our school careers. In a truly just universe, no child's last name would be Cox, Butts, or Seaman. No teenager would come from a family named the Hardens or the Balls. A young Richard Shaft wouldn't have to come home from school crying each day. An underendowed Lisa Titwell wouldn't beg her parents to let her finish her education at an all-girls school. And an adolescent Paul Feig wouldn't have had to endure hearing the letters E and I consistently taken out of his last name and replaced with the letter A. But alas, I did.
That's Paul Feig reading the opening of his new memoir, Kick Me. Now, as you point out just a little further down into your book, that, you know, a lot of kids didn't even know what the word fag meant. So even though you were being called Paul Feig, a lot of kids had no clue what that was supposed to mean. I know when I was growing up, people used the words fag, fruit, fairy, and always meant that a boy was a little effeminate. Beyond that, if it had any meaning, I don't think we knew about it.
No, I don't think they really did. I always think it must be something they heard from their fathers or from their older brothers. And it sounded like an insult, and people reacted like it was an insult, and so it just got hurled around. In my neighborhood, insults were used so oddly. For some reason, my father bought me this backpack for my books when I was in, like, second grade, and I would ride my bike to school. And there was these mean kids who, when I would ride by with that backpack, they would call me the N-word for some reason. And it didn't even make sense because I knew what that word meant. And it was like, because I have a backpack. And then if you wore white socks, you were a Polack. So there was some sort of school logic that nobody gave me the handbook on to figure out.
So would you do the whole sticks and stones thing, or would you insult the person back?
No, I was never tough enough to insult them back. I would either try to make a joke and get them to laugh, and if that didn't work, I would just hightail it out of there, basically, to my nerdier friends who were in the same boat, and we would just do dialogue from Warner Brothers cartoons and be glad that we had no athletic ability and no desire to beat up other kids like everyone around me seemed to have.
Now, your memoir of adolescence really got me thinking about some things that I haven't thought about in a while. Like, you say you'd always like girls ever since you were five. What does it mean to have a crush on a girl when you're five or six, when you're in first or second grade?
It's odd because you don't get the support of your peer group. I thought it was normal because I was just attracted to girls, and I would, you know, sort of tell that to one of my friends, and they'd give me this strange look, or like, ew, you like her? Why do you like her? And then cooties, the word cooties would generally come into play, which I don't know where the whole concept of cooties came from, but if somebody could have patented it, they would have made millions of dollars off of it. But you really felt alone in a weird way, because if you wanted to hang out with girls, it was looked at that you were being a sissy or you were a girl or something, and so they never really caught on to it. Of course, then in later years, they surged past me very quickly, figured it out, and then actually figured what the next step was, as opposed to myself, who just became best friend to every girl I knew and the safe friend.
Now, you describe your earliest feelings of sexual arousal, and this was in gym when you were climbing the ropes, and you kind of accidentally got turned on by it. And I'm really interested in hearing you talk about that feeling of confusion and discovery, realizing that something quite sensational was happening to you. Was your impulse to, like, talk about it at the next show and tell in class, or to keep it a big secret, or to run and tell your mother and father, "You'll never guess what happened to me today"?
Well, first of all, that was a very sexy rope, I just have to say.
But it was
No, I knew something was happening that was probably a private thing. But on top of it, I had thought I sort of discovered something, you know, because I never talked about that sort of thing with anybody around me. And this was back, you know, this was in the late 60s when, well, I was going to say, I guess there wasn't a lot of sexual talk on television, although it was the sexual revolution. But still, it wasn't in the shows I was watching. There wasn't a lot of talk of orgasms on Bewitched or Gilligan's Island or any of those things. So I missed out on that. But I was so happy that I had found something that seemed to be pleasure giving that you didn't have to buy or pay for, other than at that moment I thought I had to climb ropes in gym class, which I didn't enjoy doing and wasn't particularly good at, but sure put my nose to the grindstone to try to get up that rope after that first time. It's odd. I don't my poor wife, she goes, "Boy, you were very honest in this book." And to me, it was such there's few moments in your life where you have such an amazing discovery. I mean, there's times when you find a great restaurant you like, or you find a great book, or you discover a movie you've never seen. But to come across something that is so intense and life-changing as, for lack of a more discreet term, having your first orgasm, I just found it to be a profound experience. And once... It was almost disappointing once I found out that everybody experienced this, not particularly in gym class, but just as a species in general.
Was there a moment that you could put your finger on where you learned that you're supposed to feel that, you know, a lot of people were going to try to instill in you a sense of embarrassment and shame about this feeling?
Yeah. You know what it was? My family used to, my father owned this store, and he just worked constantly, but we'd always take a week off, and it was his big thing for us to go on a vacation, like to the Caribbean. He loved that. We lived in Michigan, and we wanted to go somewhere warm. So we were in the Caribbean, and we first got there, and we turned on a radio show, and there was this Caribbean, I think we were in Jamaica or something, interview show, and it was this religious show talking about masturbation, and it was all these things about how when you masturbate, you lose like a day off your life, and all these strange things about how it was going to kill you. And I remember my father looking over my mother and giving her this look, and she turned off the radio. And it was very confusing for me, because I thought, either they know I'm doing this and I'm shortening my life and they just don't want to, you know, they want to get rid of me, or it was something that was not true and needed to be shut off. But it was very odd, because I think after that I really carried this thing with me of, oh my God, maybe it's right. Maybe every time you do this this event, you're shortening your life. It's worse than cigarettes, because I heard cigarettes, you know, knock it like a minute or something each one, but this was a whole day. So there was a lot of tense moments as a young man, kind of bargaining away my life, going, okay, I don't need, if I'm 80, I probably won't need that day because it'll be a Sunday. So if I die on a Saturday, that's all right. And then, of course, very quickly bargain myself down to being about 30 years old, I think. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Paul Feig is my guest. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks. When you created the characters for Freaks and Geeks, what traits from yourself did you give to the main characters?
I actually think there's a bit of me in each character. What you tend to do is, the way I like to work is kind of break up my personality a bit and sprinkle it around.
Let's look at the two main characters, the sister and the brother. Why don't you describe each of them and tell us which of those traits came directly from your life or from people that you knew?
Well, to be honest, I always describe it as Sam Weir was me back then and Lindsay Weir is me today. Because I always feel, and people will always back this up, that teenage girls mature much quicker than teenage boys. And to the point of, I feel that teenage girls are probably at about the same emotional maturity level as guys in their 30s. Because it takes us so much longer to catch up to you guys. But for Sam, it was just this kid who really just is trying to get through the day with his friends and the things he likes, and he's not athletic, and he feels a bit intimidated by the tougher kids in school and the more popular kids, but he has a crush on the most beautiful girl in the school, the head cheerleader, which I did too. I asked this girl to go to the homecoming dance the day of the homecoming dance, thinking for some reason she would be available. It was completely relieved when she wasn't, but at least I gave it a try. And then for Lindsay, it's just the character that questions things more. I was really into just kind of not accepting things as they were, as a lot of teenagers are, but I always found that teenage girls were a little less likely to accept things as they were, at least the ones I knew back then. And I just love the idea of an adolescent questioning things, questioning everything, questioning their religion, questioning what they're being taught, questioning popularity. And so for her to go over and hang with the freaks or the burnouts was something that I was doing back then, just because I found them to be more honest and more real.
My guest is Paul Feig. Here's a scene from his TV series, Freaks and Geeks. The main characters, Sam and Lindsay, are sitting around the dinner table with their mother and father. Sam is worried because his gym teacher just announced a new rule that everyone has to shower after class.
I don't want to get naked in front of other guys.
Well, who does? Do you know how many men have seen me naked in my lifetime? A lot. But do you think I'm comfortable with it? No, but I live with it.
I just don't want them to tease me.
Oh, who would tease you?
All right, look, here's what you do. You tell them you're proud of your body. That'll show them.
Sam, you have a beautiful body, doesn't he, Harold?
Yes, I just said he had a beautiful body.
Those other boys are probably just jealous. Lindsay, tell your brother what a beautiful body he has.
Mom?
Lindsay?
What?
Your mother asked you to tell your brother that he has a beautiful body.
That is so stupid.
Lindsay, tell him.
It's not gonna help him.
Lindsay, just say the words. It'll make him feel better.
Sam, you have a beautiful body. You're an Adonis, a slab of beef. If I wasn't your sister, oh my God.
Lindsay, can it?
See, sweetheart?
A scene from the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Our guest is Paul Feig. Back after a break, this is Fresh Air. Our guest is Paul Feig, the creator of the TV series Freaks and Geeks. He has a memoir called Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence, now out in paperback. Terry spoke with him last fall.
Were there any pressures on you when you were doing Freaks and Geeks to smooth out the rough edges of any of the characters?
Oh, yeah. The head of the network at that time, I remember, had a lunch with Judd Apatow, the exec producer, and basically said, can't these kids ever win? Can't they have a victory? Like, it drove him crazy that we had one episode where Sam Weir finally goes on a date with the head cheerleader, and when they're at the restaurant, the head football player walks in, and she basically confides in Sam that she's in love with him, and ends up by saying, "I love talking to you. You're just like my sister." And it just drove him crazy. He was like, he's on a date with a cheerleader, and she talks about another guy. Can't he have a successful victory? And it's like, no, he can't, because A, then what's the series? And B, that's not how life works out. If I went out with the cheerleader, a head cheerleader, and she said she loved me, well, then my whole life would have been different, and it wouldn't have occurred, because those kind of things in my world never occurred.
I want to mention that you told me right before we started taping that your father died a couple of days ago. And first of all, I want to say how sorry I am about that. And second of all, I think it must be, you're very affectionate toward your parents in the book, even though, I mean, you're making fun of the whole experience of adolescence, which includes, you know, having some laughs at how... some laughs at your relationship with your parents, but you obviously are very affectionate about them in the book. And I think it must be a strange time to be having your book published and to be talking about all this, having just lost your father.
Yeah, it is odd. I mean, he's been sick with Parkinson's, but for a while, but he was not doing badly, so it was still quite a surprise. But I really wished he could have at least made it to the book coming out, because his picture's on the front of it. And I kept saying to him, you know, you're gonna be not famous, but I said, you're gonna be in bookstores all over the country, your pictures. So, you gotta get ready. And we joke about that, but it is sad. I mean, I really love my parents. So many artists, and especially people who do comedy, are very down on their parents or had bad childhoods or say they did and are really at odds with their parents. And I just didn't have that experience. My parents were very supportive of me. My mom just loved the idea that I was leaning towards doing something creative. And my father, who owned this army surplus store, desperately wanted me to take it over, but I was an only child also. And he saw the writing on the wall, and it was more important to him the ethic of you must be happy in your work than it was you have to do this because, you know, it's the family business or you can't let this go away. And so I feel that's the greatest thing both my parents gave me is an acceptance and a real love of life and a love of doing what you love to do.
You mentioned that your father is on the cover of your book, and you wish that he'd been alive to see it in bookstores. This is a great picture. I mean, if anybody ever challenges you and says, were you really a geek in high school, all you have to do is show them the cover of this book. And, you know, what other proof would anybody require? Can I ask you to describe this photograph?
Yeah, this photo is, the reason I put it on the cover of the book is this is a photo that would sit seriously in our house for years, and not one person ever looked at this and didn't laugh, because first of all, it's three conflicting hairstyles. My father was completely bald. My mother had hair the size of a watermelon, and I had this sort of mock John Denver meets, I don't know, some other hair disaster. John Denver meets That Girl, I guess. And we're all posed very nicely in a nice studio setting, me with my spicy new jean jacket on that I'm sure I thought made me extra cool, and until I walked out of the studio and probably was immediately beaten up in it. What I love about this picture is it just shows how clueless one can be, because it's just we just look happy, and I look like, hey, everything's great, and you know, clearly things were not great outside of the house. I had great friends, but you know, it was there's that movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is so funny because it starts with a push-in on this family portrait, and everyone looks so happy, and to me that just kills me, because you know, there's the two worlds you live in, and if you come from a nice household, there's the happy womb-like environment that you're in there, and then you're just immediately every day spit out into the real world, and you kind of at night you reset, like you know when you wake up in the morning and you kind of wake up and you forget the problems of the past day for a little bit, and you feel like it's a reset button, and the minute you walk out of the house and you get to the bus stop or you get to work or whatever, and it just starts wearing you down every day. But that's why I love pictures like this is like the reset button was hit and everyone's happy for the moment.
how Do you think the adult Paul Feig is influenced by the adolescent Paul Feig? I mean, you're pretty successful now. You've had a TV series. You're directing a movie that you're editing now. You know, you've got a new book. You know, you've done okay for yourself so far. In your book about adolescence, you describe being afraid of everything, even Ronald McDonald, and Robin and the Seven Hoods scares you in the movies. I mean, are you still as afraid and self-conscious and inhibited as you were as an adolescent?
No, I'm not. I've actually kind of swung the other way, where I'm there's not. This sounds so cavalier, but there's not a lot that scares me now. And what I find is I don't have patience for adults who get scared of things, because I worked through it. It was odd. I mean, I was literally afraid of everything when I was a kid, from thunder to dogs to anything. And at some point, I just realized I wasn't able to do anything. And I think it was right around when I was about halfway through high school, I just said to myself, you can't go on this way. It's ridiculous. You're going to cut yourself out of so much life. And there was so much stuff that I wanted to do. I always got really inspired by things I would see. Like, if I saw a movie, I wanted to be a movie actor and I wanted to direct a movie. If I saw a TV show, I wanted to have a TV show. If I read a book, I wanted to be an author. If I saw a play, I wanted to be Will Shakespeare. The good thing about all that was it made me do a lot of things, and it forced me to have to break out of who I was, because the only way you could do those things, you couldn't just really sit in your room and do those outside of writing, but you had to get out and experience things. And so I've really come full circle on it. But that said, you know, it's really hard to divorce yourself from who you were. And I'd hate to forget that, because I love those feelings of back then. I love trying to remember what that intensity of being in love with somebody when you were a teenager, that crush where it's just you feel like there's a wrench in your chest. I just, to me, it's such pure emotion, and it's really beautiful. And even though it was tough back then, to lose that, you know, there is a sense of loss about having your emotions dulled a bit.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's been really a pleasure.
Paul Feig is the author of the memoir, Kick Me, Adventures in Adolescence. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Book Week continues with David Thompson. The new edition of his biographical dictionary of film has been called a great, crazy masterpiece, as well as the finest reference book ever written about the movies. And we'll talk about the early days of TV with Lou Gould. His father, Jack Gould, was TV critic for the New York Times from 1947 to 1972.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. After World War II, when radio began to give way to a new medium called television, the New York Times responded by assigning its radio writer to cover TV on a regular basis. That writer was Jack Gould, who became one of the first and most influential TV critics at a time when the medium was fresh and experimental. He reviewed Howdy Doody, I Love Lucy, Marty, and See It Now. He also wrote essays about TV's big issues of the day, from the quiz show scandals and blacklisting to the increasing popularity and impact of television itself. Gould covered TV for The Times from 1947 until 1972 and died in 1993. His son Louis L. Gould, a professor of American history at the University of Texas at Austin, sifted through thousands of his father's reviews and essays and published a book collecting 70 of his father's most historical, original, and passionate columns. The book is called Watching Television Come of Age, The New York Times Reviews by Jack Gould. Lou Gould provides historical context for each entry, and some personal context as well. In 1947, when Jack Gould began reviewing television, he moved his family to Stamford, Connecticut, and began working from home. I spoke with Lou Gould last year when the book first came out in paperback.
Well, he believed that he should see television, which was mostly live in those days, except for, you know, the old movies and things, that he should see it the way people at home saw it. And this imposed on him severe deadlines because the Times had to put the paper to bed by, I guess, 11:30 at night. So when the programs ended at 11, he had about 15 to 17 minutes to write a 300-word review. It was a gut-wrenching experience for him, but he learned how to do it, and then he would call them up and dictate his piece over the phone to the city desk, and it would appear the next day.
Well, take us into the Gould living room or the TV room back then. When he started, you would have been, what, eight, seven? How old?
Yeah, I really am not too familiar with it until I was in my early teens, which would have been the early 50s. He didn't like much in the way of disturbances, and young boys tended to be more disturbing than encouraging. And there's some, if you read some of the pieces where he talks about us bouncing on the sofas and otherwise distracting him, you'll get a sense of how we could drive him crazy. But by the early 50s, as we got to be more mature, in our early teens, I at least, he would ask us in the watch, and we could sit there as long as we didn't say anything. And then when he was done, he would say, "That's it," and that was our cue to get out of the room, and the typewriter would start away. By the time I got to college, I could sit in the room and watch him type and still not say anything. And then sometimes he would let us read the pieces and see what we thought of them. It was an awe-inspiring experience. I can remember one occasion when we were watching one of the televised national political conventions, and Huntley and Brinkley were on a set where they were very close together. And he said, "It looks like those guys are playing kneesies out there." And the phone rang, and it was somebody from NBC. And he said, "By the way, are Chet and David playing kneesies out there?" And about 5 minutes later, over the air, Huntley and Brinkley said, "Someone in the East says we may be playing kneesies out here." And I thought, that is amazing stuff.
That is amazing.
But most of the time, he didn't, you know, get involved in the actual program, but just watched.
It is interesting when you read the columns 50 years later, and he's writing about Lucille Ball. He's writing about Rod Serling. He's writing about Patty Chayefsky. And now these people are Lucille Ball, you know, Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling. They're icons. But back then, they were just other, you know, performers, writers, and you're seeing icons being shaped. And go ahead. I just wonder.
Well, but this was what was on Tuesday, and he would go in there and sit down, and you didn't. Part of the excitement of it was that you might have a Marty or a Patterns. Now, sometimes you had a clinker and a dud, but when those magical moments came with a play that, like the Julius Caesar or Patterns or the Days of Wine and Roses, there was an immediacy and a power about it that, whatever the technical quality of television now, and it's impressive, I don't think it has that same sense that it was an event, and that the next day when you went to school or talked to people, they would say, did you see that last night? And that sense of a shared experience of people in the late 40s and early 50s is something, I guess, except for, you know, cable or some news broadcast now, there's not that sense of excitement.
Did your father's tastes strike you as odd in any respect in looking over these things?
Well, his tastes in culture generally tended to be pretty congruent with mine. I suppose that's normal for growing up with somebody, though I was more interested in modern jazz than he was. I had not realized how much he was involved as a young reporter with the nightclub scene in New York, jazz, and the swing era. He wrote a terrific article about Count Basie and how black bands at that time were discriminated against by white booking agents, which I was quite surprised to find, gratified but surprised. But he had a kind of New York theatrical kind of sensibility. As I say in the book, he thought Rodgers and Hart were terrific and was less impressed with Rodgers and Hammerstein, which is a continuing debate in that area. Not having gone to college, he was somewhat sensitive about his intellectual credentials and defensive in some instances on that. He seemed to be a very well-read and interesting man in the way that he dealt with opera, shows like Omnibus, and things where there was a range of artistic development involved. So I came to have a great deal of respect. He was obviously reading more than I thought as a child when he seemed to be, too busy to talk to me.
Was it his passion for the moral issues that had him write so many columns, or at least so many that you collected in the book, about blacklisting, about the quiz show scandals?
Well, of course, as you know, reporters tend to have a deep well of cynicism about human nature, but there's also a vein of idealism in the best of them. And he was, I think it's fair to say, allowing for prejudice, a very moral man in his view of what the networks and television should be. And he had a sense of fair play. And I think the biggest reason he was outraged by blacklisting and the quiz show scandals is that the networks had really betrayed the faith of their audience. And that, he, I think, believed was unforgivable. That it was they had the power, they had the influence over society, and it was up to them to play fair and to do the right thing. And so in some ways, now a naive and innocent view, but I must say, reading back on it, I found it as attractive now as I did at the time.
Lou, I think the next thing I'd like to ask you to do is to pick your own favorite passage from the book and maybe read a paragraph from it. If there's something that you can single out that, as a son, as an historian, for whatever reason, that you're especially proud of being able to disseminate in this new form.
I think the thing that impressed me was the See It Now column from 1951, November 19, 1951, where he talks about Murrow and his trip to Korea. And they have a documentary film made in Korea, and it talks about the soldiers on the front. And when we think about North Korea and the axis of evil and the problems that we have today, it makes you realize how short history is and how much we're still living with the results of the 1950s.
Well, go ahead and read it for us, please.
The last half of the program was devoted to a documentary film that CBS had taken in Korea. It showed all the hardship, good humor, and tension of the average soldier's existence at the front. The film was tough and real, but always thoughtful. And Mr. Murrow's sparing comments cut to the viewer's heart. When the film showed the GIs digging their foxholes, he remarked, "If you dig before dark, you have a better chance of living until light." Then came the climax. One by one, the soldiers stepped before the camera and merely gave their name and hometown. Mr. Murrow reported on what had happened to the company since the film was made. 50 casualties. With searching eyes, Mr. Murrow looked straight at the camera and said that some of the wounded might need blood. "Can you spare a pint?" he asked. To television, in short, finally has come Mr. Murrow's rare feeling for the value of understatement in reporting the news and telling the facts as they are. Those qualities obviously were a source of inspiration for all who contributed to the success of See It Now, and more important to the persons privileged to watch their efforts. Television had a taste of its true glory yesterday. I can't read that every time I read that. I choke up a little bit. I remember seeing the program, but it just seemed to me that was Dad at the top of his form. And Murrow, too.
Now, he was a television critic. We've been focusing on the early years of television because that's just so fascinating to me anyway. For him to start in 1947 as a television critic, but he actually didn't retire as a TV critic until 1972. So he had a large body of work. What was your sense of him in the later decades in terms of his relationship with television?
I think he became progressively more disillusioned. He would say that he was written out, that he'd spent 20 years glued to the tube, that he was repeating himself, that he had nothing new to say. And I think some of that was true. It was a high-tension job that wore him out physically and emotionally. But I also think that by the mid-60s, he had the sense that whatever the promise of television had been 15 years earlier, it was not to be realized or didn't seem to be realized. And after the Newton Minow episode in the early 60s with the Kennedy administration and the vast wasteland issues. that was not going to change, I think he became convinced that repetition and money-making and the high ratings were going to dominate, and that television, while it would have its moments, was not something to which he wanted to devote the rest of his life. And I think it was time. He was only a man in his late 50s by the time he retired, but he had said most of what he wanted to say and most of what he could say. And there was an arc to his career that told him that it was time to move on. And it was clear that it was.
American history professor Lew Gould, editor of a book of influential TV reviews and essays by his late father, Jack Gould. The book is called Watching Television Come of Age. Coming up, the Biographical Dictionary of Film. This is Fresh Air. David Thompson's Biographical Dictionary of Film is one of the well-worn reference works here at Fresh Air. It not only has basic biographical information on each actor, writer, producer, or director, but offers critical observations of that person's work. Thompson describes his book as personal, opinionated, and obsessive. He cautions that within nearly every entry there are things that may be startling in a biographical dictionary: the sharp expression of personal taste, jokes, digressions, insults, and eulogies. The first edition of Thompson's Biographical Dictionary was published 25 years ago. A new edition has recently been published. Thompson was born in London and now lives in San Francisco. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, Salon, Film Comment, and the London Independent. He's also the author of three novels and a biography of producer David O. Selznick. Terry spoke with Thompson last December. He writes that his favorite actress is Angie Dickinson, though, he says, many of his readers don't understand that assessment. Let's start with a film clip from the 1959 film Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne as sheriff and Angie Dickinson as a dance hall entertainer.
Where are you going?
Downstairs.
You better not.
Why, I better not.
Because I'm still a sheriff. You wear those things in public, I'll arrest you.
Oh, John T. Oh, I've waited so long for you to say that. I thought you were never... You have the funniest way of saying things. Just when you're going to say one thing, you say
now.
Something
Get
else.
Get those darn things off. I'll wait outside.
No. You don't have to go. I can use the screen. Besides, I want you to stay here because the other thing is all over now, isn't it? I'm trying to hurry, but I'm all thumbs. What I had to go through, put on these tights, ask a lot of questions, start to walk out. I thought you were never going to say it.
Say what?
That you loved me.
I said I'd arrest you.
It means the same thing. You know that. You just won't say it.
There are many people I have known and many women I have known who have found my adoration for Angie Dickinson far-fetched. They're not sure whether I'm teasing or whether I really mean it, and I'm here to tell you that I do mean it. I think that in the 1950s particularly and in the 1960s, she was an extraordinary actress, and I'm deeply fond of her. I've never met her, but everything I say about her is sincere and heartfelt. I think everything in the book is heartfelt, although sometimes I think one needs to tease people a bit. And I always understood that saying Angie Dickinson was a great actress would make people laugh, but laughter sometimes is a prelude to thought.
Now, Cary Grant, you've described him as the most fascinating male personality in pictures. Why do you give him that prized spot?
Well, it's a complicated thing. I'll be as brief as I can about it. I think essentially it comes to this, that Grant could go from lightness and humor and charm and being incredibly attractive to being dark, secretive, selfish, unpleasant. And he could do it in a moment. He could do it in a beat. And I think in a way it's that kind of ease of transition that makes the most interesting people in films, to do it without going through immense antics of acting with quotes around it, but just to let your being shift. And for years, Grant was regarded as simply a movie star. I think, again, people have come to realize that in so many ways, he's a very uneasy figure. We sort of take for granted now that he was very uneasy sexually. I think he was very uneasy with his fame. I think he was uneasy with being a hero and all of those things. And in his best work, and that's often the work for people like Hitchcock and Hawks, because he did his best with the great directors, I think you see that really volatile, uneasy personality.
I'm going to ask you to turn to the entry for the director, James Toback, the director and screenwriter. And I'm asking you to do this because he is a friend of yours. And for our listeners who don't know his movies include Fingers and The Pickup Artist. Name some other of his movies.
Harvard Man was the most recent. Black and White, Exposed, Love and Money, The Big Bang, Two Girls and a Guy.
Good. So this is you writing about somebody who's a good friend of yours.
Yes.
But as we know, as we've heard, you write very opinionated, critical entries for everybody in your biographical dictionary. So read us an excerpt of what you've done for James Toback, your friend.
Dear Jim, you may not know it, but you are the best friend I feel obliged to include in this book. That may be a wretched position for both of us. You are also one of the friends I most value in life. I then go on and I quote what was an original review of his first film, Fingers, which opened in 78 and which I reviewed as critic on The Real Paper in Boston. And now, picking up. Anyway, our friendship began a few days after this review ran, and it lasts, I hope. Have you known or guessed that I've never liked anything of yours quite as much, or nearly as much, since? Have we betrayed each other? Is it possible for a movie maker and a critic to be friends?
Well, let me ask you that question. Is it possible for a critic and a movie maker to be friends?
It's extraordinarily difficult, and it requires enormous tolerance and openness on both parts. And I would have to say that on Jim's part, and Jim and I haven't spoken for a few months, and I think he knows it's because I didn't like Harvard Man. So again, I'm sending a kind of letter to him over the air. I think it depends upon his generosity, and to me he has been an extraordinary, compulsive friend, someone I could never dream of giving up. But it's very, very difficult if you're a critic, because sooner or later the critic is going to offend the filmmaker, I think, and vice versa. And in the decades over which I've done this book, I've come to know many more people in the book. When I began the book, I don't think I had met more than two or three people who were in the book. I've probably met a couple of hundred now who are in the book. And some of them don't talk to me anymore. Some of them have become even friendlier, and I have to wonder whether that's because I happen to like them. It puts friendship to a very, very great test. But I do think that anyone in the arts knows this dilemma, and you have to make up your mind how far flattery and the critical spirit, how much those two things mean to you. And I try always to tell people what I think about their films.
Film critic David Thompson, author of The Biographical Dictionary of Film. A new edition was recently published. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with film critic David Thompson, recorded last December.
You know, Todd Haynes has a new movie that I think is very good called Far From Heaven. And it's an homage to the movies of Douglas Sirk, who made the movies Magnificent Obsession, All That Heaven Allows, Written on the Wind, Imitation of Life. You have an interesting entry on Douglas Sirk in your Biographical Dictionary of Film. Would you talk a little bit about what you see as Douglas Sirk's style and importance?
Well, Sirk was a very interesting figure. He had come out of German theater, and he came to America in the late 30s, and he gradually found his way to Universal, where in the 1950s he made a series of very successful what are called women's pictures, pictures with Rock Hudson, Jane Wyman, people like that in them. He was a great stylist. He loved color, he loved decor, he loved camera movement. And those people who just love film style for film style's sake adore Sirk and were in raptures, as I was when Far From Heaven unpeeled on the screen, because it isn't just a homage. It's as if Todd Haynes has become Douglas Sirk almost for a moment. It's just breathtakingly beautiful. The colors in the film are put together with a kind of boldness that really no one since Sirk or Michael Powell has dared to do.
We usually use the word melodrama in a very dismissive way, like, oh, it's just a melodrama. In your entry for Sirk, you sing the praises of melodrama, and you write, long live melodrama, and let us stress the quality of Douglas Sirk. What do you think of as melodrama? Like, what does melodrama mean to you, and what was his approach to it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you what melodrama is. Melodrama is going in out of the daylight, paying money to sit in the dark, packed in by strangers so that you feel you can't get out, in front of a screen the size of an ocean liner, where the screen is filled with a tear dropping from a woman's blue eye down to her red mouth. That's melodrama. It's in the nature of the movies. It's sitting in front of a screen where you know that quicker than you can close your eyes, the image can change from, say, the one I've just described to an image of a knife tearing down that woman's cheek. It's the basic melodramatic condition of not knowing what's going to happen next and longing to find out. And so long as that lives, movies will live. When people feel they've seen it all before and therefore are not surprised, are not shocked, not delighted, not moved, and maybe we're there already, that's when movies are in danger of fading away, I think.
Film critic David Thompson. He's the author of The Biographical Dictionary of Film. A new edition was recently published. Our interview was first broadcast in December of last year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of our favorite guests of the last few years, the singer and guitarist Dion. He started out in the doo-wop era with such hits as I Wonder Why, Run Around Sue, and The Wanderer. He has a new CD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.